It's the Productize Podcast. My name is Brian Castle. Thank you, as always, for tuning back in today. Got a really good conversation for you today. I'm talking to my friend Jane Portman. She is the co-founder of UserList.com. That's a SaaS product for SaaS companies. Basically, it's an email, or not just email, but a messaging product with some automation stuff and some pretty cool stuff for lifecycle emails and messages for users of SaaS products. But Jane is also the host of the popular UI Breakfast podcast. And so this was a wide-ranging interview. It's probably a little bit different from some of the recent interviews that I've been posting here on the feed. So we're going to talk kind of the inside game on running a SaaS business in the early to kind of just past the early stages. You know, UserList has been around for over 2 years, and her co-founder Benedict, they've gained some pretty good traction. And so it's kind of exciting. And they just released some pricing updates, and we talked about positioning and marketing and onboarding for that SaaS product, and also making the transition from full-time consulting or part-time consulting into full-time focus on their SaaS product together, which they've made that transition this year in 2020, and then kind of crazy timing with the pandemic coming around. So we talked all about that, but then I definitely wanted to spend a large portion of this interview talking behind the scenes of what it's like to run a popular growing podcast. It has received over 1 million downloads at this point, and she's had over 160 something episodes, doing all sorts of interviews, how she runs sponsorships on the podcast, and how that has helped grow her audience and keep in touch, and also grow the audience and customer base for her products. So yeah, a lot of kind of inside baseball on this one. Some really good insights, as always, from Jane Portman. Here you go. Enjoy. All right, Jane Portman, how are you doing?
Doing good. Thanks so much for having me, Brian.
Yeah, so I think, actually, I forgot. I think that this is your second time back on this podcast, right?
It might be, yeah.
Yeah, I think you're on in one of the earlier episodes, and people can go back to that. But a lot has happened in the last couple of years for you and your business and products and everything. So we're gonna get right into it. I think today's conversation will be a little bit different from some of the other ones that I've had on here recently. You were one of the first well-known and popular people doing productized consulting there for a while, but you've certainly made the turn into SaaS products with UserList. So, you know, we won't do the whole backstory on UserList because you've been on like Startups for the Rest of Us and other podcasts kind of giving the startup story on that, but I would like to get kind of an update on it. I mean, for those who aren't familiar, what's kind of the quick, you know, elevator pitch on what UserList is?
Sure. So UserList is a tool for sending lifecycle messages to your SaaS users, such as behavior-based email and in-app messages. We've been out for 2.5 years, and especially the last year has been great. We've been gaining traction, and we've just like barely a few hours ago announced our small $9 starter plan, which means we're essentially opening the floodgates for all small new businesses out there. And we couldn't be more thrilled. So that's a big update, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. I know. We were just talking, like, I just heard that today. And that's pretty exciting. So yeah, I mean, I definitely want to ask about your pricing. We'll get into that in just a minute. And then, of course, we're going to spend a good chunk of this conversation also talking about your UI Breakfast podcast, which I think you're up to like 167 episodes, which is really impressive.
Thank you.
And I want to get some of the behind the scenes on that. But you know, what I'm curious about with UserList right now is you said you're 2.5 years in, and I'm kind of curious about that. I don't know if I would even call you guys like early stage anymore, that you're like just post early stage or something like this early traction phase. What is it like at this point right now for UserList?
I wonder what kind of angle we can take in describing this. I think this has been a super long-term play in terms of marketing, getting exposure in the community, getting the word out. And it finally feels like, I think since basically around last fall, it was the first time we went to MicroConf and we felt like people know the name of UserList even more than they do us for the first time. Before that, we had to do the speech, like explain what it does. And now now it's finally out. And we've also been, myself and my co-founder, Benedict, we've been full-time on that since January. So we've been going full throttle, building new stuff and launching important things like this free plan and in-app messages. So it feels now that finally the pieces of the puzzle are sort of coming together. But the sales cycle for our type of industry is still super long. So we like people probably have maybe like up to years between they hear about us and between the use case for us. So let's say we announce a new plan today. This means that we will have new people on that plan, probably not even today, but when they need it. So we're all in this slow but very exciting game of building following. But it's pretty much self-sustained, so we're not pumping in cash anymore. It's not like it's paying our bills on full, but we're hoping to get there sometime sooner rather than later.
Yeah, actually, I do want to ask you about that just real quick. That you mentioned that you and Benedict, your co-founder, have both switched to working full-time on UserList, I believe at the start of this year in 2020. Is that right?
That's correct.
And I forgot which podcast I heard you on, but you had a really good conversation about that switch. But what I'm curious about there is that is the transition that so many people are gunning for. Like, how can I leave behind consulting or leave behind a job and switch to product income full time? I'm curious, like, when you guys made that switch, was UserList revenue, like your monthly recurring revenue, was it up to a point at that time, January 2020, that could like really fully sustain both of you or like replace your income? Or did you have like savings that built up sort of a runway that you can, you know, make that leap?
Definitely not making the living from it, and not yet either at the moment. We have been doing consulting all the way for those last 2 years, and it's been challenging to combine, like to mix clients work and UserList. But what really made us switch was that feeling of getting traction and being known in the community, like getting the product in good shape. And it's not the first SaaS product for either of us, and we know how slow it can be, but it's not an experiment. It's definitely something that we intend to seriously grow. The pace of growth might differ, but we are absolutely intended to grow it to a legitimate amount of MRR so it can sustain both of us. So the terms were such, we're going to do that for 6 months and then see where it takes us. Maybe we will take a little bit more consulting, but hopefully, and things have been sort of in that tune, hopefully we will not go back to consulting and we'll keep going full time on this. But yeah, general advice to anyone, don't do that. Like, it is really scary because it's very bad to be desperate for money. So unless you have good savings and serious intent, it's much better to keep consulting on the side and keep, you know, the slow game going instead of having to make desperate decisions.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that because I think that you guys did it the right, very, very smart way because you had two factors going for you. You know, it sounds like you were both in healthy financial situations going into this, but then also the business was clearly showing traction. You know, you had some level of revenue and traction that gave you that confidence that this is definitely growing, where we intend to keep growing this. It's not just an idea, an experiment anymore.
I would say the first $1,000 of MRR was brutally slow. Like, and given all the credibility, our existing audiences, the amount of podcasts we've been on, it's been still slow because the friction for adopting a tool like this is pretty high. That's been one of the surprises, one of the big learnings from running it. The positive learnings would be that.
I relate to that firsthand myself with Process Kit. For sure.
The positive surprise was how much expansion revenue is going to be awesome. Like, it came as a surprise. It was not in my business plans originally when we started it.
Interesting.
We do have a significant number of our growth resulting from our SaaS customers growing their user count. So that's really amazing.
So I know that not everyone in my audience here is totally in tune with like SaaS metrics, but when you talk about expansion revenue, you're like on top of the base plans, things that your customers are doing cause their price to go up. And I guess commonly that's like, you know, they're adding users or team, like their team is growing. But I think in UserList, it's is it like contacts or something like
that? Yeah, our basic metric is number of your users, because you send things to your users. So the end users are this axis for measuring. And expansion revenue can be both upsells, but it can be linear growth. Like in our case, it's just like linear, straightforward. They grow, we grow sort of relationship.
Got it. Just one more point on the switch to from, you know, part-time to full-time focus on this business. I mean, I do think it's worth pointing out that at least what I've seen both personally and from other people making that switch, it's still going to require some level of like a pay cut, like a personal pay cut and a little bit of a leap of faith. Again, with the signals that you're making a smart decision here. But, you know, I do see a lot of people who just keep holding out and holding on to this consulting gig or holding on to a job until their bootstrapped side project literally equals what they've been making as a full-time employee, and often like a six-figure employee. And that's just not realistic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like at some point, you just really need to kind of, you know, be willing to kind of go back to fully bootstrapping to really make that switch happen, right?
Yep, definitely.
And so then I'm curious, like after you made the switch, so like into right now, I know obviously soon after January 2020, we're hit with this global pandemic.
Oh.
But I guess putting that slightly aside for a second, has the full-time focus for you and Benedict, have you seen a really meaningful impact for the business?
Absolutely. We have firsthand, we've got this amazing freedom of mind and lack of client deadlines. It was like number one. We now can work at our own pace, do what we need to do. And of course, like we can build whatever we want at the speed of a rocket ship, but we can move along. And it took a while to get adjusted, to find right tools, right processes, to keep this going more in the more organized way. But I think now we've just hit the stride, and the last month has been really good, even though, like, I can't say that. So basically sitting at home and just churning out great things for users, that's what we do.
Yeah, cool. Let's talk about this price change. So up until today, so we're recording this here at the end of April. I think this podcast will probably come out in sometime in June.
Oh, okay, good.
Yeah, I've got a queue that's coming up before that. But so up until now, your base plan was $49, and it goes up to $99, $229 after that. And so now you're interesting a nearly free plan, but it's a $9 a month plan. Can you talk through like what was sort of the thinking behind this?
Sure. Well, any freemium is, of course, a marketing play. So it's a way to draw in more users. And we have been entertaining this for ages, but seriously entertaining this after the crisis hit. So it definitely is the case that there will be more SaaS businesses who will be on tight budget, but nonetheless starting out in these hard times. And we would love to get them on board early on. And this expansion revenue sentiment, it's the exact play we want to do here. We want people to come on board early, enjoy like our sort of micro investment at the early stage, so that then they grow and become our users at higher plans. And what's the most important thing is that we got into business to help bootstrap founders like ourselves, small to medium-sized SaaS businesses. And this jibes perfectly with this kind of spirit. We've also been considering whether to do it in full feature set or whether we should limit anything on the free
right.
plan, on the early plan. Like we got together, we put together a table with decision-making criteria and stuff. And the criteria said that we should do, let's say, in-app messaging starting from the $99 plan. And we decided on that, but it felt wrong. After like 2 weeks, I was, this doesn't jibe with what we do. So let's absolutely reverse this game and introduce a small plan and just let all the features make them available from the smallest plan, so that people can use our full feature set to grow. And it's great.
I really like that.
Yeah, it's great that when something you do, it jibes not only with the economics and the logics, but also with the reason you're in business. And that is such a great fit for us.
Totally. I really like that, the thinking there. And so far, like currently in my businesses too, it's basically set up like that all features are included. And then the difference between plans is kind of like the quantity or the expansion. And that's basically how you're doing it here. I think that this base, this $9 a month plan is up to 100 users, which makes a lot of sense because it's like, you know, we see that all the time. It's like, oh, just the other day I had to temporarily upgrade my Ahrefs because I wanted one feature that they stuck into their $200 a month plan, you know? And then I quickly downgraded it like the next month after I didn't need that feature anymore, you know? And it's like, you don't want to deal with that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and there are also some reasoning why it's not freemium exactly. And it's not because of those $9 that we want to get, but because we are in the email industry and we put together, for the free plan, we put together a document outlining the steps, the gates we need to put up in order to protect like our business from spam abusers and other things. And a $9 fee seems to be working perfectly for that. It's super small, but not zero.
I was going to ask you about that. Was spam, is that the main consideration in not going to fully free?
Yes, and there are a couple more. The other one is upgrading a cardless user can be very painful. So we want them to get on this tripwire purchase with the $9, and then we can smoothly upgrade them when the user count grows, as opposed to trying to solicit their credit card. And what do we do? Do we stop their messaging going out? Like, it's very, very sensitive at that point, like because their businesses depend on our functioning product.
Right, right. Yeah, it could literally be like a one-click upgrade. And then, like you say, I guess maybe there's some flexibility in like if they go over their limit, but they haven't fully upgraded yet, you know, you can kind of smooth that transition.
Yeah.
Very nice. I wanted to touch on your positioning, because I know that you've done a lot of work on that early on, you know, really positioning it for SaaS products. And then even within that, as I understood it, you know, correct me if I'm wrong or if this has changed, but UserList, so it's like a messaging tool for SaaS companies to message with their users, and it's strictly post-purchase, like people who've become customers of your SaaS product, that's when UserList starts to communicate with them. Is that right?
That's exactly right.
Got it. How have you worked out that positioning? I know you've done some like work on that, and what were some of the changes and kind of realizations you've made on that?
We set out from day one to approach to only work with users who are the customers, but it took us like a year and a half to figure out how to describe that to people so that they instantly get it. Because we also do what we do can be called email automation. So we would start out with a pitch saying, we do email automation for SaaS. And everybody would start comparing us to MailChimp or Drip. And this is just entirely different tools. I mean, they work in the similar manner, but they're for marketing. And we do more of behavior-based lifecycle stuff. So last year, about a year ago, we did this positioning exercise based on the book by April Dunford. And there's a huge blog post with outlining the steps and showing like the tables we put together. So maybe you can link to that in the show notes instead of me reciting it. What we arrived at
is... Yeah, it's a good one. I read it when you came out with it. It's good.
What we arrived at is that we should call ourselves customer messaging because based on the features we can and cannot offer. And we also figured out that most likely our audience is small SaaS founders, bootstrap SaaS founders. And in that regard, things have changed since last year. We have figured out the angle, but we were sort of a little bit scared to go full on the small business angle because everybody says you shouldn't do that. Everybody says like you should charge more, aspire for bigger customers, you know, grow your MRR, but I read a book by Simon Sinek this year, Start With Why, and then The Infinite Game, the other one. I found them hugely useful and inspiring. And he says that those businesses succeed who have a bigger purpose than just making money. And for us, that bigger purpose was helping bootstrap founders like ourselves. And that we've been more open about that since that over the last few months. And it also explains why what we have been doing in marketing works when we try to, let's say, share our story and be open. But when we try to compete on educational content with some giants like Customer.io, Intercom, we lose because they have 100 people teams putting together some amazing guides. Like we can't possibly do that without resources. but we can be outcompeting them on that bootstrap vibe, on the idea that we understand the needs of a small founder. So we've become more straightforward with that. And it's just such a pleasure to directly, again, align your messaging and your goals and your business purpose.
Yeah, totally. And so like, what other things, like when it comes to, so from your positioning to your like marketing messages to the things that you're doing for marketing, I know you're doing like a lot with podcasting, like on your own podcast, but also, you know, you're going on a lot of other podcasts. Hey, you're on a podcast right now. Like other things when it comes to marketing, like how have you kind of tied together that positioning? It's for bootstrapped SaaS. I guess it's not only for bootstrapped companies, but you know, for SaaS companies, and how is that all kind of tied together with how you're acquiring new trials, new customers?
Well, podcasting is more of a medium that we enjoy, and it's not just me. Benedict also runs a show together.
Yep.
It's called Slow and Steady. So you should totally check it out with Brian Ray. And they talk about building user lists.
One of my other favorite bootstrapper podcasts.
Oh, great. So yeah. I sometimes I'm envious that I don't have a chance to talk about user lists that often on public. Because Benedict has a chance to talk about this every week, literally. So we enjoy this medium, and appearing on other shows from time to time has been part of our marketing strategy. But other than that, the podcast for me, Yoy Breakfast Podcast, has been more of a way to learn from some awesome people, to have meaningful conversations with them, to make connections in a good way. And over the years, it just grew into such a thing that just lives on its own, sort of. Like, it would be cruel to kill it, because we have really good numbers and just crossed 1 million downloads in March. So it's been going on for 5.5 years by now.
Yeah, sweet. All right. I really want to dive into that in just a second. I think my only other question about user list right now is your onboarding process. That's sort of something that I'm currently focused on as we record this. I'm like heading into a big overhaul or improvement of my onboarding process for Process Kit. I'm curious, like what have you learned in, and especially since UserList, the product is sort of there to facilitate a lot of SaaS companies' onboarding process and messaging with users. So I'm curious, like what are some of the best practices, but also what do you guys do with UserList when it comes to, you know, like, well, first of all, like, do you do, actually, I see the button here, you do some booking of demo calls. How does that play into the trial process? How do you nurture trials before they've converted? Yeah, how do you approach that kind of stuff?
I just wrote a huge article on that, outlining the exact steps a few weeks ago. So if we recap the principles we use, is that, well, we're pretty opinionated on that. And part of that is because I'm a UX consultant myself by trade. So I'm not a fan of like tooltips and walkthroughs and everything that like distracts you from the product itself. So when the user gets on board, they just see one welcome video from us. And the purpose of this welcome video is to solely establish the friendly vibe instead of trying to educate them at once. What like the most important work is done in the background. We'd have a huge knowledge base, not huge, but a very reasonably sized quality knowledge base. And we do have an onboarding sequence sent out via user list. But in the ideal world, we would prefer to not send anything to the user. So it all is tuned such a way that we use behavior data to skip on irrelevant tips. So we have like an onboarding with, let's say, 5 messages. And if this integration has been already established, we just don't send this one. If they already are composing campaigns, we don't send another one. And a big part of what we do is also suggesting onboarding calls. And we don't do that many of them, so people don't really take up on them every day. Maybe that will change with the free plan. Let's see. But so far, so good. These onboarding calls, they're also baked in into the sequence. So we offer, like on day 2, we offer a onboarding call with founders. So we prefer to offer personable help when it's needed the most. And we also learn a lot. It's like a form of customer research. And like our goal is really to interfere less, and so far, so good. And it might have been different if we had a different kind of product. But in our industry, there is friction every single touch point. Like the success journey, it's enormously long, from making the integration, like with the developer, jumping into code, then setting up your messages. It's really hard to enforce the person to do something. So our goal is more to inspire them with some samples, with some templates, with some success stories. So maybe when they get inspired, they can jump in and do the work. Otherwise, you can take the horse to water, but you can't make them drink.
Just a minute to tell you about Process Kit. If your operation needs to become more efficient and more predictable so that your team never lets anything fall through the cracks, then it's time to implement Process Kit. Process Kit is process-driven project management software made for powering client services businesses. It's especially designed with productized services in mind. Create powerful SOPs with built-in if-this-then-that automations, and then use those processes to power all of your repeatable projects. Whether you're managing a pipeline of new clients onboarding to your service, or tracking weekly deliverables, sales proposals, marketing assets, or admin work, Process Kit is your team's place for getting it all done, but more importantly, done right. Use our powerful Zapier integration to hook Process Kit into all of your other systems. And if you'd like expert help with improving your processes and automations, ask about our Process Kit Implementer service. Request your free demo and trial at processkit.com. Right, right. I mean, I've been dealing with a lot of that with Process Kit, because it's the same sort of idea that it does require a lot of work to set up processes, set up the automations, connect Zapier, do whatever you need to do to really implement it mm-hmm. in your business. And I've set myself up on email automation tools as well. And that's been like month-long projects to just get up and running, right?
I've heard you found love with customer.io, and it's indeed a great tool.
I know. I wasn't going to mention it, because I know you guys sort of consider them competitors.
Oh, it's all right. I mean, they have a radically different pricing. Their base plan is $150.
Yeah.
That is different from a $9 plan.
I've been bouncing around, you know, with the email tools. I've literally bounced like from Drip to MailChimp to ConvertKit to ActiveCampaign, like back to Drip and then to Customer.io. And I think I'm solid for a while.
I literally have your words about everyone dumbing down email automation tools. It's like tattooed on my forehead, your tweet.
Yeah.
Like, not like we're offended, but indeed, you could say that UserList is exactly dumbing down email automation, but we're hoping that we are doing that well, because we know who exactly we're doing that for.
So. Yeah, I mean, you're really optimizing it for the SaaS use case, right? Converting trials to customers and the life cycle. And I think that makes a ton of sense.
Yeah.
And I mean, you being an amazing designer and UX person, it really shows. And I think that goes a long way. Because like, honestly, I've used like all those different tools, and I would get so frustrated even when it does everything that I need it to do. If the interface is terrible and I'm just frustrated the whole time, I just don't want to pay for it. That's just how I am.
I feel you. I think and our people who get in touch with us, they confirm that the whole market of tools like this, it's super crowded, but there is no clarity on what things do, because there are so many words used to describe what we do, what other like tools do. And there is a mix of features like messaging, one-way messaging, two-way messaging, support, automation, all kinds of things. And they come together in different different combinations, different tools. And if we have overall better education about ourselves and about our competitors, we're all going to win. We just want to have clarity about the market.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. Okay, let's talk about UI Breakfast. So UIbreakfast.com, that has been your personal site for forever. And I mean, you know, you've had that site for a while. That used to be like your productized consulting website and everything, and your personal blog. But I guess it's been, what, like 2 years or so you've been doing this podcast. Is that right?
The podcast has been out since 2014. So it's five and
really?
A half years.
Oh, wow. I didn't realize it's been that long.
I guess that's what it takes to make things work.
So you're doing, you know, lots of interviews. So is it coming out every week? Is that right?
Yeah. And it's been changing with time. And the first episodes went out in the fall of 2014. Then the next year was sort of like once in a blue moon, kind of just publishing whenever I feel so. And then I got on the publishing train in 2016 and for a couple years have been super consistently publishing every week. And that's when it started to ramp up. The sponsorships came along and stuff. And then in 2018, I got pregnant with my third child. And it was obvious that I couldn't support this weekly publishing schedule. And I was about to sunset it or put it in a pause. But my friend suggested, well, maybe you could just publish it less frequently. And for the last couple of years, it's been going out every 2 weeks.
Okay.
But since January, I decided, well, shall I sunset it or shall I double down on it? Because it's either one could work. And I decided to turn on the weekly schedule again. And it's been weekly again for the last few months.
Yeah, awesome. And so the focus over there is, who are you kind of seeking out as guests for the podcast?
I'm so excited to be talking to you about this. Like, I don't really get to talk about the show. I just get to talk on the show, but not about the show.
Yeah.
The angle, well, UI UX is the original angle, product strategy. But since I'm definitely a SaaS person myself, then when I come across people who are interested from a SaaS standpoint, related to the business of SaaS, I also try to bring them along. And there is a mix. I get a ton of inbound guest suggestions like every day. Some of them I take on. So a number of people that I have on the show, I would never find myself, especially amazing. My favorite category is the upcoming book authors, because what their publishers do, they would rake popular podcasts and suggest them as guests. So that's how I got a couple really amazing guests lately, and not just lately, but over the years. Other than that, I try to find people in our community who have very niche knowledge on some topic and try to talk to them about that. So it's not about getting famous names, even though famous names don't hurt, of course, but it's more about finding interesting people, smart people, because there are a ton of them who don't necessarily have a huge audience. I mean, they can come from absolutely different background.
Yeah. I mean, you know, this is one of my biggest questions that I had for you is about how you find guests and how you prepare for them. We'll get into that in a second. But, you know, I started this podcast back up this year in 2020. Mm-hmm. It went on like a 2-year hiatus because, frankly, I got burned out on finding guests every single week. And then I just let it go. And so that was one of my biggest hesitations with starting it back up this year was how am I going to keep a continuous steady flow of guests? And right now I'm still in that early batch of folks that I just happen to know. I mean, you're one of them. I know your story and I was happy to invite you back on the podcast, but it is much harder to get really great guests who you don't really know much about them. And I'm sure we're the same in that, I don't want to bring on guests who I just don't want to bring someone on who's not going to be interesting for me or for my audience. And it requires some background research before they come on. Like, how do you kind of manage that workload?
If I had unlimited free time, I would absolutely happily go and find dozens of amazing guests because interesting people are all over the internet and start. Like, you can start with one designer. Like, let's say I don't have too many designer friends, but some I do. So I would, let's say, come out and explore their Twitter feed or their connections and see who they work with. And then I would research the person's public profile. So for almost everyone can be a good guest, unless if they have something to talk about. And we would love to have some proof. So one proof would be reasonable articles, books. And ideally, if you want to have like close to 100% confidence, then you'd be better off finding some public talk because YouTube is full of them. You'd be better off finding a video with them. And that can be a good understanding of how they feel on air if you're afraid to invite just random people on your show. So there are different ways of validation. And usually I would come across a very interesting article and then I would like, oh, I want to talk about that on the show. And then I would reach out to the author. And what I love about reaching out is that inviting people to be guests, it's always a pleasure. It's not like cold email or anything. It's cold, but it's absolutely wonderful. They always come back happy, and there is absolutely no friction in getting people on board, usually. And that's such a pleasant process. It's a gift.
Yeah, it's genuinely a win-win, right?
Yeah. And then you get to have a meaningful conversation with them. So it's a very mutually beneficial thing. So that's enjoyable, definitely.
Yeah, for sure. I'm sort of the same way. I look for topics or interesting threads first, and then I invite the person on, especially when it's someone who's not as well known. I'm just looking for something that they're doing a little bit differently, a little bit unique, and that's a good storyline to jump off from. And also now I'm working with Will King, who is helping me out with some of the guest research and recruiting, where he's doing some of that upfront background research, and then he's giving me like a brief about them for me to, like, you know, confirm, yep, this person looks good to invite. Like, what does your team look like in terms of, you know, keeping the production schedule up? How are you doing editing? But is anybody else helping you out with like the guest research or background or prep?
No, it's just me. And since I have a lot of inbound guest requests, I don't spend that much on research. And it's usually it's like a pleasant hobby to find guests, and it's not really troublesome. So that's me doing that. And since January, I hired Podcast Motor by Craig Hute. So they've been doing my editing, and that really cleared up a lot of my load on that front.
Yeah, they're one of the great productized services out there. We've been, I think Bootstrapped Web might be their number one or customer number two, something like that.
Yeah. And I could have probably paid a little extra and make them put together the show notes, but I take special pride in my show notes because I like to make them informative for my mailing list, even if they don't have a chance to listen. Because typically it's a collection of links on the topic, interesting articles. So it's not like I put the links in, whatever the mention is. And I also try to make an explanation what that is. And it's also a good chance to sort of leave again through the conversation. So it's kind of pleasant. Awesome. So I don't delegate that.
Yeah, that's great. I don't write my show notes. I probably should. But I mean, is your podcast these days, is that really your primary, I mean, it must be like your primary audience connection? Like, I mean, I know you write articles sometimes, but like, is that the way that the people who really follow you tune into your newsletter and everything, that's their primary way of keeping a pulse on what you're up to?
Yes, I do have a wonderful audience in MailChimp. So with their newsletter I have, the audience is about 8,000 people. And I don't do anything these days to grow it. So it's kind of organically fluctuating, but around that number for the last couple of years. Yeah, what they receive in their inbox is weekly podcast episodes. But whenever I have something to say, let's say a birthday announcement, or like I have a new business, or like sort of a new article or year in your review, I can always get back to them. And since they've been receiving podcast episodes every week, it's not a cold email list. It's definitely very warm. So unfortunately, I'm not blogging particularly for UI Breakfast because I'm blogging mostly for UserList. But nonetheless, that audience is super crucial to me. I really love the fact that I have these people.
Yeah, for sure. And so you mentioned over a million downloads, which is amazing. As I'm looking at the website right now, I think it's like 167 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk a little bit about the growth? Like, were there any milestones or certain things that happened? Like, was it changing the frequency of the episodes, getting certain types of guests, like anything that just sort of like clicked where you saw inflection points in the growth of the listenership?
It's been pretty smooth over the years. And 2016 was the year when it started to click together more, because in 2016, I generally speaking just did more things out there and I got consistent with the publishing schedule. So consistency is one. And then growing your list, I think growing my list also coincided with some podcast growth. And then I think sometime later, the podcast kind of outgrew the mailing list, I think. Not in terms of numbers, but in terms of being successful and things like that. I've been changing up the format a little bit. And one of the key things was putting a topic onto each episode. That was pretty early. So that was an important but early decision. And then I introduced a Blitz questionnaire for the guests. It lasted for a year or two. I was asking sort of icebreaker questions, the same five questions to everyone who was in the show. And then I ran a survey to my list and everybody says, well, this gets really boring. And I was like, oh no, I should just shut everything down. I've been working so hard that I don't like it. But then I kind of pulled myself together and listened to that. And the two primary pieces of feedback were, let's skip on the bliss questionnaire and get through the foam straight to the beer kind of sentiment. So I did that. And the other one was to strive for shorter episodes. The ideal length is about half an hour. And I often exceed that, but I always strive for something about half an hour. People want to be to finish episodes in a smaller sitting. And I do my best to get the guest warmed up before the recording. So when we hit record, it's more productive and we get that stride faster. Because everything interesting usually is always the last 20 minutes, no matter what the episode looks like. Yeah. Like the last 20 or 10 minutes is the most exciting stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Well, we've cruised right past the 30-minute mark here on this one, but okay. So I have a bunch of questions to unpack all that you were just saying. So I am a subscriber of your podcast, and I listen to it. I'm probably one of the subscribers that you probably don't like. Like I dip into it like once every several weeks when the interviewee seems like someone I'm interested in. So I haven't been up on all the different changes in your format. But when you say a topic for every episode, do you mean a topic with the guest or something that like a topic that you're talking about before you go to the conversation?
Yeah, so I find a guest and then we decide on a narrow angle that we'll be talking about. There are other shows out there will have like, oh, this is episode 150 with Brian Castle, and that would be it. Like,
right.
In our case, we want to talk about, like, let's say, productized consulting with Brian Castle, or even more, like, something more narrow with Brian Castle. So we would do that. So people, one way they can get interested is about the name of the guest, and the other one, if the topic is relevant to them. For example, we had some really interesting conversations about naming brands last week, and, I don't know, behavior-based design.
Yeah. And that's really helpful especially when the guests are not as well known. It's like, I want to tune in for the topic, you know?
Yes, definitely. And since the topic of design in general is pretty broad, the topic of UI UX is broad. Like you can talk about icons, microcopy, you can talk about all types of user research, any stage of the flow, then there is SaaS and there is a whole angle of different SaaS topics. So there's never shortage of those. And it's super interesting to learn myself. Like I learned a ton from my awesome guests.
Yeah. So the other thing, and then I just wanted to touch on sponsorships real quick. You mentioned that you did a survey. I've sent so many surveys to my audience over the years about different products that I'm working on and content, but I've never, I've never surveyed them about my podcasting. And one of the hardest things about podcasts, I'm sure you've seen this, maybe you have some insight, is like running a podcast is one of the hardest things to get feedback on. I feel like the audience is generally pretty silent. Like I'll get comments and some email replies and tweets and stuff here and there, but most people are tuning in on their podcatcher
and that's it.
They're just out there. And then maybe you see them at a conference and they happen to know like everything about your life, but like... how do you deal with that? Like, you know, how do you get the audience feedback? And I guess you used the survey, but anything
well,
else?
One thing, if you're lucky to have a mailing list, you can survey them and talk to them there. Well, but not every podcaster has a mailing list for sure. So I guess the recipe to success is to have one somehow to start building it sooner rather than later. And then you can hope for some mentions on Twitter. Let's say you have a Twitter account for your show. You publish episodes there and you would mention your guests so that your guests would hopefully retweet those. I wouldn't count on that as a massive growth thing, but such kind of growth definitely happens. So they would retweet. And then when people want to share the episode, hopefully they will be able to find your Twitter handle and mention you. So that's a way to see what episodes resonate more. But that's still super inactive. Like... It's definitely not a source of all-time truth. And what's worse, is that iTunes reviews can be negative. And that can be super hard on you because you work hard. And then you come in there and somebody says, oh, she has such an awkward interviewing style. Or what's worse, the host was great, but, you know, the guest was he behaved badly or something. So, like, one star. Why?
Yeah. Like, who are these people? They really have nothing better to do than leave a one-star review?
Probably. But over time, as the episode, the show grows, you become more confident. The number of positive reviews grows. Also, one handy tip is to ask your guests for leaving a review. And since they're on this like positive note of receiving a podcast appearance, they might actually do that. So it's a good way to grow that trend. Well, there are different types of engagements. Like you can ask what is startups for the rest of us are reading aloud their reviews and somebody else is doing that.
Right.
I'm not. Because my production...
I haven't been doing like enough attention on reviews. I should do more.
Generally speaking, my production process is kind of time agnostic. Like I usually record an episode and then goes in production and I don't put any up-to-date information in it before it goes live. So I wouldn't spend extra time updating the show with like this snippet of audio that has the recent reviews. It would be quite hard technically for my flow. So that's another reason why I didn't do that.
This has been like a pet shiny object idea that I've had forever that I haven't been able to do, but I would love the ability to have like a real-time audio clip that I can insert on all of the episodes in my feed.
Like a snippet variable or something.
Yeah. And like I've spent an embarrassing amount of time like really looking into this idea and thinking about doing it, but I never really did. But yeah, like if I were able to like publish, you know, so I'm coming out with my interview shows every week, but then at the first 2 minutes are like a live update of what I'm up to, or it's like a live sponsor that only chose to sponsor the month of June. You know, mm-hmm. and so they get aired on all episodes in my feed for the month of June, but then that goes away. Like I think there are some tools out there that are sort of doing that, but not quite the way that I want it. So I don't know.
If this helps, well, since we're talking about technical like details, I do have sponsorships, so I record sponsorship scripts separately.
Yeah.
So my editing process is not doesn't have a backlog, so I would publish an episode and send the other one in production. So it's like always 1 week fresh. So I would send over the recording from a while ago with the appropriate sponsorship for the date, and then it will get blended together in an episode right before publication. So helps to keep the sponsorships within the schedule.
Wait, so your sponsors, when somebody sponsors an episode, are they permanently on that episode for life, or do you have a system to only... They've only paid for a window of time.
No, they just remain there in the audio track forever. That's not a wizard. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's sure. Like
no. Yeah. That's like the typical like model for it. And so I am curious about the sponsorship stuff. So like, I think you said it was like 2016. It was around then when you started doing it. Like, what was the milestone in terms of like listenership that you felt like it was a good time? Or that you were able to start monetizing with sponsors?
So the show's been consistent for a while, and I don't exactly remember the numbers, but I talked to Kurt Elster, and he said, oh, you know, to run sponsorships, you just start running sponsorships. So I don't exactly remember the moment. Maybe I suggested to run a sponsorship for a couple of my friends, or because I still do that once in a blue moon. But I put up this sponsorship page with the terms and conditions, and somehow I sold a couple slots. Maybe I reached out to Balsamic because they're one of my friends. And so I started with Balsamic, and then the sponsorship script in the show notes, it has the ending line saying like, you want to get sponsorship? Here's the link. So that always there in every episode. So it's easy to find. And then it started going from there, and then it wasn't very hard to find more, I guess. And I'm quite positive that the listeners, like, you have to provide the stats for the advertisers to know, but it's not like you can't find sponsors for a small show. It's basically you set the price, you decide, and you get them.
I'm looking at your sponsorship page info now. And you put a lot of really good information about the stats and everything. But like you're saying, you don't really need, I mean, you do have a lot of like listenership here, but like other shows don't necessarily need a large audience if you're just trying to reach a niche audience and your product is very relevant, it could still be a good fit.
I'm very sure that exposing to a very small but very loyal audience is much better than going live on Tim Ferriss' show for thousands of dollars. So there is always a niche and you can get exposure. You can start with some smaller fees and just get the ball rolling. That's the key part.
And so we won't get into all the pricing here, but the way that you do it is you have single episodes and a block of four and a block of eight. How varied has the sponsors have the sponsors been? Are you constantly dealing with sales to different sponsors, or do you have just repeat buyers who are there most of the year?
Typically, I would have somebody buy a block of four or eight episodes, and then they would probably go and find some other opportunities. And another tragic thing about podcast sponsorships is it's super hard to track attribution. So even though every sponsor and its recommendation to put up the dedicated landing page to track the UTM tags or whatever, and we do have the custom URLs, still, if you hear the brand name, if you're going to go and type it in the browser, who knows how you learned about that. I'm quite positive that whoever advertises on my show, they either don't care about the numbers, or if they do, they probably observe low numbers. That's the reality.
Right. And you mentioned that you pre-record the ad spots. How do you decide the structure? So are you doing ads at pre-roll, so before the whole episode, or mid-roll, in the middle? And how many different sponsors do you include in each episode?
I have one pre-roll. So I have a short intro announcing the guest. Then there is the sponsorship script, which is about 30 seconds or 40 words or something like that. And then we just continue the conversation. That's all for me. But I'm sure you can get creative there, depending on your format.
Got it. Very cool, Jane. Well, you're continuously up to some really interesting things here. And it's just been awesome to see, you and Benedict's growth with UserList and, of course, the UI Breakfast podcast. I'm a listener, and that's been really, it's really cool to hear some behind the scenes of what it's like to run a podcast. I mean, I'm trying to do it here with this Productized podcast, but you're right, not enough people are talking about that behind, everybody's listening to podcasts, but nobody knows what really goes into actually producing it and making it happen. So this has been cool.
I feel like we barely scratched the surface because I have so much more to share. This minute details how to have a giant spreadsheet and put your guests there and how to do all other technical things. But yeah, that might be one of those little books to write there. But podcast industry is definitely ramping up.
Oh, for sure. We'll need to get you back on the show at some point.
Thanks so much for having. It was exciting to share.
Cool. All right. Thanks, Jane. All right. Did that give you something to think about? If it did, let me know on Twitter. I'm at CastJam. If you want to find show notes on this or any of the other episodes, or my weekly newsletter with new content, head over to productizeandscale.com. Now, if you haven't already, a 5-star review in iTunes, that would go a long way to helping other folks find the show. Thanks for tuning in. I'll see you next time.